We now want to embark on and turn really kind of head directly into this wind of what does it look like for us to form communities of goodness and beauty? What does it mean for us to form confessional communities? And how does what we have learned so far about shame, how do we see, what do we know about what Jesus has done about this and is doing about this, has modeled for us things to do that we can do, but that I will alert us to in advance has side effects, and that is not easy to do, not because it's complicated, but because it's hard. It's just hard to do. It's hard because it can be frightening. It's hard because it creates within us the need to be vulnerable when we haven't practiced that a lot. But I simply want to suggest that in considering and in doing the things that we're going to talk about doing, we're actually living like God lives and living like God lived on the earth when he was here in the form of Jesus. But as has become our practice, I want us to invite you to put down your writing tools and sit and listen to this again. Pay attention to what you sense, what you image, what you feel, what you're thinking, as we welcome yet one more version of beauty and creativity into this space.
Where do I fit in? Though the is torn and shaken. Even if your heart is breaking, it's waiting for you to awaken. Someday you will learn to be still.
Learn to be still. The Eagles, their Hell Freezes Over album. Still trying to juxtapose those two titles. Learn to be still. The reason I'm inviting us to pay attention to that phrase comes directly from the 40th Psalm. Be still and know that I'm God. And this notion of what it means to know that I am God is not the notion of know that I am an abstract, logically, linearly postulated left hemispheric fact. The notion of know that I am God is the same notion that any one of us in this room would want to say to anyone else by whom we would want to be known. And in order for them to know us, in order for us to be known by them, it would require for them to sit still long enough to be with us, to look at us, to know who we are. And so as we come to the edge of this water where we're going to wade into answering the question, well, what do we do about shame? We may come here eager to do something. We want to have answers to questions, right? We're ready to write, but not on our cell phones, because they're put away under my chair. And at the very time that we get to this point where we want to know that we know that we know, so we have these answers so we can go home and apply this immediately, instead we are being invited by God not to begin with activity, but to begin with stillness, to begin with silence. And I'm bringing this to our attention because I want to suggest to us that one of evil's primary methodologies of enacting shame is to keep us moving and busy. To keep my mental activity, remember those things that I sense, image, feel, and think, to keep them alive and active so that I'm not actually pausing and still long enough to pay attention to the God who is in the room at this moment. For this reason, I want to invite us just briefly to turn our attention to something that some of you may be quite familiar with, some of you may be less familiar with, some of us may not really have much exposure to it at all, and that is the contemplative tradition of our faith. I don't know how many of us have any kind of regular contemplative practice or not, but I want to suggest to you that one of the simplest and most effective ways to enter into the work that we are now going to embark upon is to practice contemplative prayer. You're like, well, gosh, what the heck is that? Some of us have maybe never even heard of this. We might not know. Remember, it was God's idea for us to be still in order for him to be known. Contemplative practice and contemplative prayer tradition in the Christian faith has its roots that date all the way to David, all the way to the meditations, to the practice of meditation. It's not just some phenomenon that comes out of Eastern religious traditions of Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth. It is something that is part of the Judeo-Christian tradition and heritage for as long as we've been around. And many of us just don't have much practice learning about this. Our Eastern Orthodox brothers and sisters have been doing this for centuries as a matter of common practical fact of their faith tradition. We just haven't had this much practice in the West with this. But some of us here in the room might be steeped in this. There are certain things that the contemplative tradition will tell us in his book, Silence on Fire. The author says there are two pillars on which contemplative tradition stands. First pillar is this: to be aware of the fact that it is God in whom we live and move and have our being. As Paul writes, and Paul talks about in that conversation in the book of Acts, it is in God in whom we live and move and have our being. If God were to disappear from the world, so would we. In Christ, all things are held together. Now, the problem, of course, is that when we are living and moving in our world, we don't tend to think much about God being something that is present with me all the time. I tend to think about God as being wholly other. And this is part of my problem, because I think, and this, of course, is how, this is what evil is counting on. Evil counts on there be this sense that what shame does, it keeps me separate from, right? It keeps me over here and God over here. It prevents me from considering that even in the moment where I have committed my worst shaming act, God is as close to me as he ever has been. The question is whether or not I'm paying attention to this. Am I paying attention on a regular daily basis to this notion that God is that person, that being, that life in whom I live and move and have my being? This is what the biblical narrative tells us flat out in the book of Acts. That's pillar number one. Pillar number two is that it's really important to pay attention all the time to pillar number one. The instructions are quite simple. There's a lovely little book called Into the Silent Land. Not more than 100 pages. A gentleman by the name of Martin Laird, I would recommend that you get it, and that you read it, and that you put it into practice. And one of the things that Laird points to, one of the things that he draws our attention to, is this question of what does it mean for us to become aware of who we are? Who we are. Right? We've been talking about what the mind is. Right? Have we not talked about this? Right? What the mind is. But listen to this from Colossians chapter 3. So if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds, there's that word again, set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. We mentioned this yesterday. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Now, when we mentioned it yesterday, one of the questions that I had for us is, when you hear those words, for you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God, what comes to mind? Is that just an abstract theological fact? Or does it have any actual impact on my mind, that part of me that is embodied and relational, emerging from within and between brains, whose purpose it is to regulate the flow of energy and information? Am I paying attention at all times that I am with Jesus? Jesus is with me, and we are hidden in God. I would dare say that most of us would read this passage and we would like, we like the notion, we like the idea. We like the sense that like, that's true in some abstract world. I have no idea what it means practically. What if it means this, for example? What if it means that I'm going to spend 10 minutes every morning doing centering prayer work that enables me to, with every breath, be attuned to being with Jesus, Jesus being with me, hidden in God, in whom I live and move and have my being? Now you might say, great, Kurt, but can you give it to me in yards, right? Can you show me, like, how am I supposed to do this? Well, no. No, in that what I mean by that is that for you to imagine this is going to be work you're going to have to do. And this is work that is hard to do. And it's hard to do because I have to practice imagining something that I have not practiced imagining in my life. Are you with me? It's not very sexy. It's not very fun at first. But what happens when in the course of your day, as you begin to practice paying attention to this sense, this imagined sense that I've got this 33-year-old Palestinian guy with me who's hidden, like he's with me and we are hidden, we are in God. What does that imply? What kind of implication does that have in the moment that I'm about to lose my temper with my boss? What implication does this have if this is what I'm paying attention to? Notice what Paul says. So if you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above. And as we said yesterday, in his language, he's not talking about above as in above the earth or above as in some ethereal heaven. He's talking about seek the things of God. What does it mean for us to, let's say, do this exercise? I'm going to give you these words, love, that you might be familiar with them. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, right? Galatians chapter 5, right? You're on it, right? How many of us take each of those words and that word, the word joy, for instance, peace, patience, joy is going to be the word that you meditate upon, that you practice saying over and over, that you're thinking about, that you are directing your attention to, this is my word for the week, or this is my word for the day. And I have to be committed to paying attention to this. This is what it means for me to turn my attention to things that are above. This is what it means when you're about to have that hard conversation, or when you are about to have that condemning conversation in your head about yourself. It is about practicing paying attention to these words. But like, okay, what is peace? Like, what the heck is this? What is joy? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. Like, what are those things? Yes, they're fruit of the Spirit. Blah, blah, blah. Like, what is that? As we said yesterday, until and or unless we are able to embody change, change is not real. Until and or unless I can embody these virtues, imagine them in real time and space, they aren't real. And when do they become real? They become real when they are tested. They become real in those moments in which I am being asked to be patient when I don't want to be. When I was in medical school, our attending used to say, if you don't think of the diagnosis, the ER patient, you won't make the diagnosis. Meaning, if the patient comes in and gives you a whole list of symptoms, they're not at the end of their symptom list saying, and I think I have Crohn's disease, by the way, doctor. I think there's your diagnosis. I'm going to have to, with intention, think about this, draw my mind to this in order for me to be aware of it and call on it when the time is right. Does that make sense? This is the kind of work that I said earlier, like, we don't want to do this. I don't want to take the time it's going to take for me to say, like, I'm going to spend 10 minutes just thinking about what it means for me to be a person of peace, me to be a person of patience, for me to be a person of joy, of faithfulness, all those things. These are all things that we're being asked to draw our attention to, that the contemplative tradition invites us into as examples of what it means for us to pay attention to the things that are above. Laird, in his book, gives this example, and I think it's a helpful one. The things that we have thus far talked about that have to do with the mind, our sensations, images, feelings, thoughts, behaviors, all those things. Imagine this for a moment. Mountains, these large landmass structures, mountains have this way of creating their own weather patterns. You know about that, right? They're big enough that weather patterns emerge around mountains simply because of the mass effect of the mountain itself. Laird suggests that all these things that are going on in our mind, all these things that are going on, are like the weather patterns around the mountain. What I sense, what I image, what I feel, what I think. And right, you know, even right now, if you wanted to, because we said that one of the things that we humans do that like other animals don't do, we think about what we think about. We reflect on what we are reflecting on. And at any given moment, if you had to, you could stop and be aware of what your body is sensing, what your nonverbal cues are because you've just crossed your arms. I can be crossing my arms and at the same time being aware that I'm crossing my arms. But the me that is doing the awareness of, the me that is thinking about and reflecting on the part of me that is crossing my arms is not crossing my arms. I'm thinking about what I'm doing. Does that make sense? Laird would suggest all those things that I'm doing in those eight different domains of the mind, they are like the weather patterns around the mountain. You are the mountain. You're not the weather patterns. Who you are in your essence is the mountain. You're not the weather pattern around the mountain. But my capacity to be aware that the mountain is what I am has everything to do with how I am mostly focusing my attention with intention on any given day. But most of us get up in the morning and the alarm goes off and we are automatons into the day. We go and we are simply responding to the next stimulus. That's all we're doing. And some of that stimulus comes from outside of our skin, and some of that stimulus comes from inside of our skin, and we are not with intention choosing to be aware that we are the mountain, we are not the weather patterns around the mountain. Colossians 3 is calling us to a different kind of life. And the reason that we're even pointing this out is because if we're going to do work on shame, you say, well, what's the solution to this problem? I'm going to tell you that the solution begins within us. The solution does not begin by like, here are the five steps that you do to like conquering shame. Go home and do that. Like, we are the problem. But it is within our capacity, through the power of the Holy Spirit, who is dwelling within us joyfully, mind you, for us to begin this process of paying attention to the Jesus who is with us and delighted to be so, with whom we are hidden in the God who is also equally delighted to hide us as we walk through the day. But it's difficult for us to do this if we are not practicing stillness. But when we begin to practice stillness, we then create space to do what we can do to dismantle shame and create opportunity for vocational renewal. And we then do that by looking at a text from the 12th chapter of Hebrews. The first two verses of the 12th chapter of Hebrews give us a template for what it means for us to begin this process of healing shame and this process that extends then into vocational regeneration, that gives us space to create outposts of goodness and beauty that bear witness to the kingdom of God. Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off the sin that so easily distracts or entangles us, and run with perseverance the race set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher or completer or perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. Don't you love this next phrase? Scorning its shame, and now sits at the right hand of God. I want to suggest that yesterday we talked about how God's intention for storytelling begins and ends with joy. We've learned how evil uses shame to try to tell that story very differently. And I want to suggest that this, the gospel, and what we'll see here in this Hebrews passage is a way for us to retell the story, retell your story, retell my story, retell our story together, because as we know, no one tells their story in isolation. We are all storytellers collaboratively. Therefore, since there is such a great cloud of witnesses. Now, this text is explicitly referencing chapter 11, which comes before it, which talks about a lot of dead people. Okay? Most of them are dead. But people of the faith. But here's my invitation for us. Who is your great cloud of witnesses? Who is in it? Who are the people who are witnessing your life? Who are the people who bear witness to you? If you could give me the three people whose names, when I spoke to them, they could tell me everything there is to know about you, who would they be? Therefore, since we have such a great cloud of witnesses, here's another example of something that we can do. I don't know how often you read biographies of people of the faith, but it's a really good thing to do. It's a really good thing to read well-written biographies of Christians who have lived long in the past and even current ones, about people who know what it means to follow Jesus because they know it's hard to do. When we are interacting with other people's lives who are bearing witness to us, it changes how our brain operates. So the first question is going to be, if we're going to live into this world of goodness and beauty, we have to do so in a community. And our community is that cloud of witnesses with whom we will live and move and have our being inside of God. Who will they be? Now, one of the immediate questions that comes up for this is, I don't know, Kurt. I think you're going to give us that list as well by the end of the day. Right? How do we find a community like this? How do we identify people by whom I will be deeply known? Nobody does that. I had the privilege of reading a book by a guy named Paul Borgman, and the book is called Genesis, The Story We Haven't Heard. And in this book, Borgman talks about, he is a professor of literature at Gordon College, and he teaches this course, he teaches Genesis as a literature piece once a year. And in this book, he talks about Abraham and Jacob and Joseph. These are the three characters that he talks about as literature characters. And one of the things that he says about Abraham is this, which I find to be really intriguing. He said, you know, he said, I find it strange. Like, who knows? Who knows how many people God contacted before he finally got somebody named Abram to agree to go to Palestine? Who knows? We don't know. There's no story there. But imagine, who knows how long God was walking throughout Ur of Chaldea, trying to find some dude who will go with him to Palestine. You know, like God's hitchhiking there, and he's looking for somebody who will stop and pick him up along the way. The Hebrews suggest, the early rabbis suggest, that the bush that was burning for Moses in Exodus chapter 2 and 3. The bush had been burning for a long, long time. How long did it take for Moses to notice this? And that then makes me think this. The Gospels, early in each of their rendering of the disciples, tell us the names of these chaps. And it's easy for us to think that Jesus' ministry began, and then, like, within 6 hours, he's got 12 guys lined up, right? He's all got them named, highlighted, right? They've all been vetted, security clearances, except for the Judas guy. It's all already set. It's all gone, right? And I got a question. I'm thinking, like, oh, my gosh. How many people did Jesus ask to join him who said no? We don't know, because they're not remembered. Before, he got 12 guys that would finally do this. I want to say, the idea of recruiting people to live in the world of the kingdom of God is hard to do. And if Jesus were here, he would say, like, no kidding. It is hard to do, and I know exactly what it's like. Trying to get people to follow you. And then I get people, and then some people ask later on, they say, like, no, I got to go bury my dad. Or I just bought some land that I haven't looked at yet. But I need to go check it out after I bought it. Right? All these reasons for not doing it. It's important to know. Recruiting people to do this work is not easy to do. You want to have a great cloud of witnesses? How do we do it? You start by thinking of one person with whom you would be willing to do something like, something as simple as reading Lectio Divina. Anybody here familiar with Lectio Divina? If you're not familiar with it, Lectio Divina. Look it up. Do it. You won't want to do it. No. Because you know why? Because I've already told you that you have to sleep longer. You're going to have to take longer to eat your meals. Only half of them, right? All these, and you're going to be practicing learning how to, like, speak Russian and play the piano. All these things that you're doing to increase neuroplasticity. And now I have to do Lectio Divina. Like, you want me to do some Latin thing. I don't even know what Latin word means, right? Yes, I do. These kinds of scriptural practices, doing something with someone. And then in addition, you say, like, I would like to tell you my story. And I would like for us to write our stories out, like we talked about yesterday, autobiographically. And I would like then to read our stories to each other. And already they're like, they're out of the room with their hair on fire, right? You know what I mean. We read the gospel and Jesus says to James and John, like, hey, come follow me. And they just dropped their nets and went. And I'm thinking, like, really? Like, I'm not assuming that, like, he just walks up and says, hey, come follow me. They just dropped their nets for, like, without having some sense of, like, what they're doing. This is hard to recruit people. Where do you find people? So I was speaking in Nashville a few years ago, and we were talking about this very thing, talking about what does it mean for us to begin to practice confessional communities, practice recruiting people who are going to be my great cloud of witnesses by whom I'm going to be deeply known. And I said to them, it's going to be hard to do. You might not even want to do it. 6 months later, I get an email from three women. And they say, we are the three women that you said were not going to do this. And they said, we have been practicing these acts of confession. We've been practicing telling each other our stories. We've been practicing not allowing shame to be harbored. And here's the strange thing. They said, what's really strange is that in each of our situations, people in our places of employment are asking us what's different about our lives. They say, like, you're just much more calm. You're much more at ease with yourself, with us. You're much more creative. You've got much more energy. Like, what is going on with you? They were creating an outpost of goodness and beauty by virtue of their living within the context of a cloud of witnesses who was bearing witness to each other's life. I went back to Nashville about a year after that, and then two of these three women approached me and said, things were going along really well, and then we crossed into a certain part of telling our stories in which one of our parties really couldn't tolerate it. They entered into a part of their story. There was a conflict between us, and we tried to repair the rupture, and they couldn't do it. It's important to know that this is hard to do, and there may be side effects. And some of those side effects include the experience that some people get to places where eventually you start to touch parts of their heart that they cannot tolerate looking at. Are you with me? And you see, that's the thing, like, those of us who are in the room, we may be some of those people for whom those parts of our story that we don't want touched are going to be the very things that are going to cause us to leave that kind of community. Because this is really hard to do. And evil doesn't want you doing it. Who will be your great cloud of witnesses? So right now, and some of you, here's the thing, some of you may already be doing this. You're already, like, you might not be doing it by this name, but, like, you already have a group of people by whom you are being deeply known. And the question is not who, but the question is what. What of my story do my people not yet know? What of my story do my people not yet know? There are some things that we tell people are some helpful ways of asking questions, because one of the things that we want to do is reveal our story, telling the truth about those things where we feel most ashamed. And there are some ways to do this that are non-condemning. Here's a shortcut. There are six, in the English language, there are six interrogatory words we use for questions. Who, what, where, when, how, and why. Now, the thing about the first five, who, what, where, when, and how, are questions that, for the most part, any time they are asked for the purpose of acquiring information. How did you do that? What did your father say to you? What was your emotional response, John, when your father put you in the creek in January with no shoes or socks? The why question is a question that is used interchangeably for lots of different reasons. It's not a bad word, but we discourage people from using it because frequently the why question can come with a certain element of condemnation. Why did you do that? Now, again, it's not because it, again, this is about technicality. Why is not a bad question. It's just to give you some, like, boots on the ground, technical instruction about why those first five words can often be far more useful than the use of this last word. If we are then going to share our stories with others, we also want to give them the freedom to ask us who, what, where, when, how, which, of course, can feel a little scary. But this is what it means for us to cultivate a cloud of witnesses. But here's the other thing. It's not just that who will be the witnesses for me. It's important to know, you are the light of the world. Have we said that? You are the light of the world. You are in the world to bear witness to another's life in order for their life also to be transformed by your bearing witness to it. And what does it mean to bear witness? We're going to hear that in just a minute about, like, practically speaking, what does this look like? If you have this great cloud of witnesses, therefore, throw off every sin that so easily entangles. This gets back to the notion that it's important for us to be able to say no to things. God's no is sitting at the center of his yes. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to do something right now. I want you to, if you've got something to write on, and if you don't, that's all right. You can be a slacker. I want you to take, if you have a piece of paper, I want you to write down three names of people that you wish could be in your cloud or who already are, that you wish could be. Now, I know. You see, here's the thing. Many of us think, like, well, I'd love for Carolyn. No, she's too busy. I'd love for Jim. No, he lives 10 miles away. We have all these reasons why people, like, can't be part of our cloud of witnesses. I'm not asking for that. I'm asking for what you want. What are you looking for? Jesus asked. I want you to write down three names of people you wish could be in your cloud, and I'm going to give you about 15 seconds. Done. Now, the reason I don't give you like 3 minutes is because we'll take 3 minutes to put off putting names down. Because it's hard to do. Because like the minute that I name people, right, there's the risk that he's going to ask me the next question, which I'm going to. Between now and Sunday night, what do you need to do to contact them to ask them to be part of your cloud? Right? Okay? You don't have to write that down. Right? I want you to write it down. At some point, like, what do I need to do? What are the three easy steps that I need to do to make contact with these people and say, like, I'd like you to be part of my cloud of witnesses? And they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, what does that mean? Right? And you're going to tell them, I want you to bear witness to my life. Because it is in the bearing witness of each other's lives that we become a community of goodness and beauty. Next, I'm going to give you 15 seconds as well. I want you to write down three things that you know that you need to throw off that present themselves as sin for you. Now, before I'm going to tell you when to go. Now, this is the tricky part, right? Because you're sitting at tables, and you're going to start like, I can write them, but not so anyone else can see them. All right, I get that. I get that we're not looking, you know, for a poster board, right? Three things. You can have your code words for them. You get 15 seconds. Go. All right, you're done. Now, I don't know how difficult you found that to be. But I want to suggest that shame does not want you thinking about that. Shame does not want you writing it down. And shame and evil certainly do not want you telling this to anybody else. Because the minute you name things, God tames them. The minute you put these things on the table, they come into the light. The minute that we reveal who we are, we tell our story more accurately. Therefore, since we have this great cloud of witnesses, that by Sunday night we will have begun the process of organizing, we are going to throw off the sin that so easily entangles. One translation says the sin that so easily distracts. The sin that so easily distracts us. It is fair to say that all sin, we may have said this yesterday, all sin begins with distraction. A shift of my attention from one thing to the next. The conversation in the Garden of Eden is a shift in the woman's attention. All sin begins with distraction. How well am I paying attention to what I'm paying attention to? Throwing those things off. This is hard to do. This becomes like a full-time job. It's a full-time job. Throwing off the sin that so easily distracts, running with perseverance, the race set out before us. And there is that word again, the word perseverance. Practicing, 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 practicing. We know that living into the kingdom of God requires that we are thinking about a future, an eschatology that is certainly coming. But most of where we spend our time is not necessarily in the future of the new heaven and the new earth. I'll speak for myself. Most of our time is spent with me thinking about the things in the future that I'm worried about. I don't quite get to the new heaven and the new earth. It's all the worry stuff that happens between now and then that I pay attention to. Or I think about the things about my past that I regret. This is where we spend most of our waking time. Instead of in the only time that you have. Dan said now a couple of times, this notion of wanting to live where my feet are planted. It's a beautiful phrase. I want to live where I actually am. Now, the brain has an interesting way of living in the present moment, right? If we live in the present moment, if we are practicing being right where we are, not letting my mind wander away in condemning dialogue about the future or about the past, which is what shame wants to do to me, but being in the present moment, picturing being with Jesus, hidden in God, which takes work to do, if this is what I'm doing, it enables me to continue to put one foot in front of the other, to persevere in this present moment. Part of what makes doing hard work over a long period of time difficult is largely about what my brain does with the future. It's largely about the fact that I anticipate the future. I keep thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, I still have another 50 yards of this ditch to dig. And as long as I'm thinking about the ditch that I have yet to dig, I'm not digging the ditch that is in front of me. And the more time I spend thinking about all the work that I haven't gotten done yet, the more anxious I become and the less work I get done. Perseverance is about living in the present moment. It is about practicing being in the only time that we have. Condemnation, one of those hallmarks of shame, condemnation is largely about engaging my left hemispheric activity in an act of judgment, right? I'm going to step away from myself or from others, and I'm going to analyze you, to judge you. And in so doing, I create greater anxiety within me, because this is what shame does. When we are made ashamed, when we activate this, and remember, most of our shame experience is self-induced. Most of our shame experience is self-induced. I'm doing it to myself in my head. If I am persevering in the present moment, it's virtually impossible for me to be ashamed. Because shame is all about allowing myself to analyze my past or my future and condemn it. Run with perseverance the race set before you, fixing your eyes on Jesus. Now, here's the first question that I would have for us. When we fix our eyes on Jesus, what do we see? When we imagine that phrase, fix your eyes on Jesus, I'm like, what does that mean? Like, he's not in the room? I don't see him. Let me invite us to consider this, that the first and foremost thing that we are invited to fix our eyes on, we are fixing our eyes on Jesus, fixing his eyes on us. The first thing that I see is Jesus seeing me. And to what degree am I practicing paying attention to the image of a 33-year-old Palestinian, who is a 33-year-old Jew who's looking at me, looking at him while he's looking at me? Right? That whole thing, this back and forth. Every baby comes into the world looking for someone, looking for him, looking for someone, looking for her. And Jesus is always looking for us. The question is, how much practice am I giving to fixing my gaze on the one whose gaze never leaves me? How do we do this? Well, imagine this for a moment. I don't know how many of you enter into this practice. This is a practical thing that you can do. This is all combating this shame piece, because we are confessing our lives to others. We are writing our autobiographies. We are telling these stories to each other on a regular weekly basis, probably, meeting with one another, praying with one another about these things, about our stories that we are putting out here. But at this point, fixing our eyes on Jesus can be done by imagining a story from the gospel. Imagine this. If you were one of John the Baptist's disciples who came along looking for Jesus in John chapter 1, and Jesus turned to you and said, "What are you looking for?" What would that look like? It's a serious question. Where would you be? What would you be wearing? What would Jesus be wearing? What would he look like? How kind would be his eyes? If you were sitting at the table next to Zacchaeus in his house, after Jesus invites him in and says, like, "We're going to your place for dinner, bro," what would it be like to sit at that table with this short man, very wealthy, and you've been invited to come to this table? What would that be like to listen to Jesus? It is not enough for us to just read the Gospels. We must be in the Gospels. We must practice putting ourselves in these stories This is what stories are intended to do. They invite us to become part of it. When you read a good novel, if you read a really good novel, you know you're in the middle of a good novel when you are in the novel. You know that you're in a really well-told story in a movie theater when you are in the movie. This is what the Gospels are. They're well-told stories. What of those stories are we willing to be present with? Where are you going to sit in the Sermon on the Mount? Where are you going to be seated? I don't know if anybody's ever been to Palestine and seen the mountain down into the sea where Jesus preached, but where are you going to sit when he does that? Where are you going to be at the Last Supper? Where are you going to be on the Mount of Transfiguration? Where are you going to be when the man in John 9 is healed? What's it going to look like? What's it going to feel like? And to what degree are we allowing those stories and the Jesus that we look at, that we fix our gaze on, who turns to us and says, I'm so glad you're here at Zacchaeus' house, because if you hadn't come, I was going to come get you and have you come anyway. Are we able to imagine that this Jesus is the one who is coming to find us as eagerly as he came to find Zacchaeus? These kinds of practices are the kinds of practices that form who we are as followers of Jesus. We don't become followers of Jesus. We don't try to become Christians by simply assenting to a certain set of criterion theologically and then show up on church and worship well and go home and hope that it works. Jesus was up early and up late doing this kind of work. Up early and up late doing all kinds of things that are hard to do, not because they're complicated. Hard to do because they take lots of effort. And hard to do because for Jesus they were done as one who only could do them because he was the only guy that could do what Messiah could do. There's only one of those. But even Messiah in Gethsemane says, boys, like, I need help. Would you please not fall asleep? Even Jesus asks for community. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, which means we don't just see him seeing us, we see what he does and we do what he does. And what does he do? Well, here's one thing that he experienced. And here's where I'm going to invite you to once again, put down your writing tools and allow yourselves to get comfortable. Hopefully not so comfortable that you fall asleep. We're going to take a break at 2:45. But I have an exercise that I want us to do. In the third chapter of Luke, we hear the story of Jesus' baptism. And rightly so, the story is largely about Jesus. It is a story about him and what happens to him. I would suggest that it equally is a story about God the Father. But it's not a story that we hear very often. We hear a story in which, in the first person, God speaks to Jesus and says, you are my son, whom I loved and am well pleased. And we, the readers, bear witness to this, and we are seeing and hearing something about what is declared about Jesus. And all that's true. But I'm going to ask you this question. What kind of God is it that says such a thing to his son? What kind of a God is that? I want to suggest to you that what God said to Jesus, he's been saying to every human on the planet for as long as we've been alive. It's just that Jesus was paying attention. So I'm going to invite you now to relax and close your eyes. If you find that you get sleepy, feel free to open your eyes just a little bit to keep yourself awake. Because I want you to be relaxed, but I want you to be alert. And now I want you to just simply take two deep breaths, in and out, slowly, intentionally, two deep breaths. And once you've done that, I want to invite you to now simply draw your attention to your awareness of your being in this auditorium and being with a lot of other people who have come to join you. In your mind's eye, you can see the people around your table. You can imagine people seated in other tables or behind you, the stadium seating. And now I want to invite you to allow your imagination and the focus of your attention to begin to shift away from this space to a different space of your own choosing, a space of beauty, a space that is representative of strength. It could be any place that you choose. A place where you've been or a place that you've never been. And it may take a few moments for us to arrive in this space, but when you do, I simply want to invite you to begin to look around in this new space of strength and beauty. Notice what you see. You could be inside. You could be near a body of water. You could be near a mountain, a meadow, a field. You could be in your lawn, your backyard. You could be inside in your sitting in your favorite chair. And I want to invite you to notice not only what you see, but notice what you hear. Notice what you smell. Notice the ambient air temperature. Notice the color. Notice whether you're seated or standing. Be aware of your posture. And now I want to invite you to allow for the presence of God to join you. And God will come as He will. He may come from before you, from behind you, from beside you. But I want to invite you to notice that He regards you. I want to invite you to be aware of His awareness of you and of His gaze upon you. Noticing His kindness, noticing His delight. Noticing Him delighting in your presence. And now hear your God say this: You are my daughter, whom I love, and in whom I am so very well pleased. You are my son, I cannot believe that I get to be your father. You are my daughter. I could not be more proud of anyone. And no one takes you out of my hand. You are my son, and I know how hard you work. It is so not lost on me, and I want you not to ever worry that you will lose me. You are my daughter, and I am your father. You are my delight, and I don't want you to ever forget it. You are my son, you are my daughter, and I am for you. You are the one I love. You are the one in whom I am so well pleased. And that never changes. And I want you to remember it. Now I want to invite you to allow for your God to begin the process of moving as he will. Moving, but never, ever leaving you alone. And in the wake of his movement, I once again invite you to attune to this space of strength and beauty that you and God have shared and will share again. Notice the color, the sound. Notice what is under your feet. Notice what is in your heart. Remember that you have been loved by your Father, who is more than heaven and earth, proud of you, pleased with you, and never leaves you or forsakes you. And now I want to invite you to begin the process of moving from this space of strength and beauty, returning to this space in this room. Gradually finding your way again to your chair, noticing your posture and your feet on the floor. And now, when you are ready, but not before, I want to invite you to allow your eyes to open, returning to this space awake, alert, and attuned. When you are ready, and not before. This is a large room, and it's not always easy to hear without a microphone. But I'm going to ask and invite you, as you are able and willing, for the next 90 seconds to say as loudly as you can so that others can hear you, so that I can, say one word that describes what your experience was being in that space.
Peace.
Peace. Accepting. Love.
Charity.
Reassurance. Joy. Reassurance.
Peace.
Peace. Security. Freedom.
Relating.
Calm.
Belonging.
Quiet.
Safety.
Rest.
Warmth.
Sweet.
Strength.
Stillness. Old. Did I say old? Whole. Stillness.
Sacred.
Comfort.
Unity.
Accepted.
Home.
Presence.
Love.
Doubt.
Joy.
I'm going to pause this for just a second. I want to suggest that no matter what happened in this last 10, 15 minutes, that you've just been in the presence of and the activity of the Holy Spirit. Now, you see, a scientific plausibility structure would say, oh, no, this was just a guided visual imagery experience in which we manufactured and constructed things in the course of our own brain. And we want to say that it is, of course, in the context of our brain, this good dirt that God has used, into which he has breathed the breath of life, that of course he's going to come and use that context to allow himself to be imagined. How else does he do things? He does things seriously by taking seriously the way we have been made. Our problem is that we're not paying attention to a God who says to us, you are my daughter. You are my son. We're not paying attention to that. And I want to suggest that this is what Jesus has been, was, is always paying attention to. I only do that which I see my Father doing. And I want to suggest that he is up early and up late listening, reminding himself of this voice that comes, the power of the Spirit in the form of a dove that says, you are mine. Who wouldn't be able to do what Jesus does when this becomes the dominant voice with whom I am collaboratively telling my moment-to-moment, day-to-day story? Fixing our eyes on Jesus includes seeing what he did and doing what he did, which means paying attention to the Holy Spirit's work in being God's voice, reminding us of who and whose we are. But I will tell you, it will be easy for you to leave here and that be the last time you ever do that exercise. Because evil doesn't want it to happen, and we are busy people. But this is what neuroplasticity would teach us, that the more I am paying attention to this voice, this becomes what my brain is embedded with. This becomes the act in which I am obediently, as our young biblical scholar asked earlier, I am obediently going as Jesus told the blind man to go and paying attention to what I'm paying attention to, which is, you are my daughter, you are my son, and no one takes you out of my hand. No one. It's important to know that when our Father in this space comes calling, the experience can be disruptive. Not everyone who undertakes this task finds it to be immediately comforting. Because we may have our own story of fathers who have not been delighted in us, and it's difficult for us to escape from that implicit memory, which is why it is so crucial for us to have a cloud of witnesses of people into whose faces I look, whose voices I hear, whose eyes I see, who tell me, you belong to Jesus. Who tell me, our older brother is coming for you. And not even death is going to get in his way. This is the beginning of what it means to no longer allow shame to have the talking stick in the conversation of life. To first pay attention to the fact that we belong to Jesus. But this cannot remain some kind of abstract theological precept. It must be embodied in the context of community, the nature of which takes place in our great cloud of witnesses.